I think we'll get started. If you want to come up to the table, we are used to this other committee kind of crowding us out, and so I think the members have gotten used to coming late, unfortunately. We'll call it to order the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. Members will start and people will kind of drift in. Today, we have a national speaker with us. Her name's Danielle Ewan, and she's the director of Child Care and Early Education team at the Center for Law and Social Policy. What I'm excited about is she is going to talk about sort of the race to the top application, but for early ed, which is really on quality. So I think it's an exciting opportunity. Before that, we do have a video. Representative Ward, as you might recall, requested having videos. So now we have a video ready. He's not here. So we're going to start with that and get a few more members, and then we'll work into Danielle's testimony. And we'll hear from the department on the Early Learning Challenge Fund, and then we're going to hear from Head Start. So Emily, our page, is going to get this going. How many of you have seen this? Have you guys seen this one? This is pretty good. This is very good.
That's me at 4 months old. I'm one of the thousands of little miracles born into poverty every day. That's my mom. She's 17 and never finished high school. She's got some big dreams for me. But she's alone and she's scared. This is my first birthday. That's my grandma. My cousin Tanya and my boyfriend Kevin. We all live together. It's cold and crowded. I hope we'll move soon. I don't like Kevin. He's always yelling. This is my second birthday. We're all at daycare, strapped in, watching TV again. I wish I could just run around. This is my third birthday. My brother William's taking care of me while my mom sleeps. She works the night shift, so we can't turn up the TV. But we get to go to bed whenever we want. This is my fourth birthday. I'm sleeping with my aunts this month. I don't know where my dad's coming home, but I'm hungry and I miss him.
This is my fifth birthday. This is my first day of kindergarten. I'm tired.
I'm hungry. I'm unprepared.
Because I didn't get the right start. My choice is likely to be in special education.
30% more likely to never go to college.
70% more likely to be arrested for a violent crime.
Become a teen parent.
Drop out of school. Never hold a job.
Spend the rest of my life in poverty.
My mom plays with me all the time. She smiles a lot now, and she knows she's not alone anymore.
Grandma, Tanya, and Kevin read me a story every night before I go to bed.
I go to my school every day, where I get to run and play and see all my new friends.
Will and I go to preschool together. Today, we learned about dinosaurs and played a counting game.
Every morning, my dad and I brush our teeth and do breakfast together. We have our own place now. Nana will always be together.
This is my first day of kindergarten. I'm rested, I'm eager,
I'm confident,
I'm curious,
I'm prepared.
I'm ready. I am your future.
Change the first 5 years and you change everything.
Anyone interested in investing?
Okay, so Representative Ward, that was upon your suggestion of adding a video, and I know you liked that one in particular.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I just think it's powerful. I think it's the message that we've been saying over and over and over about why we do what we do and try to invest in early childhood and child care, and the earlier that we get them, the better they're going to be. There's no question about it, and I think we should play that every day in this committee myself.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, there's a thought. Thank you. Well, with that, we will proceed with the testimony from Daniel Ewan, who's from the Director of Child Care and Early Education, the Center for Law and Social Policy. And she already has presented to a group here in Minnesota, about 30 or 40 people. So getting the idea about the Early Childhood Challenge Grant Fund, if I got that right. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm thrilled to be here. As Representative Slawick said, I am Daniel Ewan. I am the Director of Child Care and Early Education at the Center for Law and Social Policy. We're a progressive nonprofit research, policy, and advocacy organization in Washington, D.C., dedicated to finding policy solutions that work for low-income families. I look at the child care piece of that set of solutions. My job is to figure out how to make sure that more low-income children are in higher quality care. And from that perspective, I'm thrilled to be here today to talk about the proposed Early Learning Challenge Fund. I will talk a little bit about where it is and some of the time frame, but mostly I want to talk about what it is and why I think it's important enough to talk about a piece of proposed legislation that I'm sitting here in Minnesota after waiting in the airport 5 hours last night for my flight to actually take off. And I have to apologize in advance. I will have to leave right at 5:30 because I have to be on my flight back. I'm a working mom, as I know many of you are, and that makes it very difficult to be out of town. So thank you for your tolerance. And I won't talk too fast, hopefully, and we'll have time for questions, and hopefully I can get to all the details. I want to start by talking about why Washington is talking about an Early Learning Challenge Fund, which sounds like something that could be something to everyone. Maybe it's a pre-K program. Maybe it's some data money. Maybe it's a plan to have every state make a quality rating and improvement system. Maybe it's a little bit of money to providers. What it is a plan to promote quality for children birth to five who are disadvantaged. And the reason why that is the message coming out of Washington is because we have reached a time where, based on new research and data, there is a really significant understanding that it is time to stop having the conversation about, is it better to have access to some child care, or is it better that we have some quality child care and it doesn't matter who gets it. The time has come to change the conversation and to talk about access to quality for our most disadvantaged children. And the Early Learning Challenge Fund comes out of that point of view. The Challenge Fund is focused on the child care and early education system because research shows that our children are in child care. Families need child care to go to work. And across the country, the vast majority of our children are in some form of out-of-home care for some portion of the day, week, month, or year. Some of our children are with a loving grandmother. We saw that on the video. Some of our children are in child care homes where they're seated in front of a TV for part of the day, or maybe they're involved in high-quality, developmentally appropriate activities. Some of our children are in child care centers. Some are in state pre-K programs that are either in child care or in preschools in public school settings. Some of our children are in Head Start and in early Head Start. But many of our children, the majority of our children, are in some kind of care out of home, while their parents are at work. And the time has come to really think about what happens to those children birth to five during those hours that they're in child care. The new research I referenced has recently found that we can identify disparities in children's cognitive abilities at 9 months of age. At 9 months, we now know whether children are going to be can be delayed in their language development, in their cognitive development, if they'll have some social-emotional delays. We can see that happening. And the research shows that children who have multiple risk factors, they live in poor households, they face extreme poverty, they live with parents who have not graduated from high school, they live with parents who have limited English proficiency, they are homeless, they are food insecure, they don't have access to appropriate medical care or preventative medical care, they don't have access to dental care. Those children that face those factors are likely to be significant number of points behind in development at 9 months of age. We have seen across the country that states have invested in many different kinds of initiatives for children, for infants and toddlers, for preschool-aged children in pre-K, high-quality kindergarten, thinking about how to link pre-K through third-grade initiatives. But many of those initiatives are siloed. Many of those initiatives don't look at children across the age range, and many of those initiatives don't focus on our most disadvantaged children. The time has come from the federal level to think about a systems approach to building access to quality for children birth to five who are the most disadvantaged. And that's where the Early Learning Challenge Fund comes in. The Congress has, the House of Representatives has passed the fund. It has a single metric in it that I'm going to discuss. You will hear me say the words birth to five. You will hear me say the words disadvantaged, and you'll hear me say the words access to high quality. If you remember nothing else from my testimony today, please remember that this is an incentive program to help more disadvantaged children get access to high quality. It is not about a single piece of the system. It is not about simply getting access. It's about raising how many children are in those high quality programs. So having said all that, let me go into the fund. Before I talk about the actual content, let me do some caveats. Again, I'm from Washington, right, so I have to waffle. The Challenge Fund has been passed only by the House of Representatives. You can see that it's Title IV of a piece of legislation that was passed in August. The presentation I'm going to make today only talks about the House-passed language. We don't currently have Senate language to discuss, so it could change a little bit from what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to largely focus on the data-based metrics because those are the ones that I think states should be paying the most attention to and I think will drive the competition for the funds. While I will talk about some specifics, there will be significant opportunity for regulation and guidance out of the Departments of Education and Health and Human Services who will be overseeing the fund once it passes. And I am required to say that anything I say here is simply based on my organization's understanding of what's in the proposed legislation, and I am not a federal employee, and I don't get to make guidance or regulation. So, with that, let me begin. The Challenge Fund is divided into two different kinds of competitive grants. States will apply for the grants and will have to show how they meet a set of criteria, a set of components, to be competitive for one of those two kinds of grants. Which grant they're applying for will probably be determined by the agency, so it's not important at this point to talk about the different kinds of grants. But the application requirements are these. Significantly, the state will give a description of how it will use the grant to implement quality initiatives to improve early learning programs serving disadvantaged children from birth to age five to meet the metric, all those words I said earlier. The application will most likely be composed of 16 different components. Importantly, they're not all required. So please don't think that because your state doesn't do everything that I'm going to talk about, that it makes Minnesota non-competitive. I would argue, in fact, that many of the investments that the state has made over time, some of the pilots, the thinking that has gone into building a system, really position the state to be competitive for one of these grants. Included in the components is a required quality rating and improvement system that has the following characteristics that you can see on the screen. I think the most important ones that are on that screen are research-based approaches to quality improvement, and addressing staff qualifications and professional development, and providing financial incentives and supports to programs to meet and sustain quality. In other words, the fund wants states to really think about how to drive dollars down to where children are to improve the quality of those settings. It's about really thinking about what happens to children on a daily basis. Those choices that you saw in the video, how can we promote those really lovely, wonderful settings for children on a daily basis? What are the interventions that the state can put in place to make quality happen every day?
Ms. Ewan, I just want to take a minute. How would the grants be? And then I want to just tell the members that even though this hasn't passed the Senate yet, she's going to suggest some things that potentially we could do. So it's important we could maybe put some things in place. As we know, for Race to the Top and different programs like this, if you're not on the ball and we don't, you know, get up to speed, the application process is going to be very quick. And so we would have to respond almost immediately as it's passed. I also want to take a minute and pass the minutes. Representative Kulik Jackson. You had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, and I move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Kulik Jackson moves approval of the minutes for February 18th. Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes for February 18th are approved, so thank you for that, Representative Kulik Jackson. So thank you. Can you give us some context on the size of the grant?
Yeah, I can. Well, I can, and I can.
And I don't want to distract you from your presentation either.
Oh, no, but please ask as many questions as you want. This is background. So the program itself is currently proposed in the House at $8 billion over 8 years. That is, just for the record, the largest single investment in early childhood at one time from the federal level ever. This is a game changer. This is the gold medal. This is the first time we have gotten to talk about quality investments in a very, very real way. The money on the table is significant. It is real. There is a real interest in moving it forward. How much money each individual grant will be remains to be seen, I'll be really honest. We don't know, but we have been given to understand that the intent is that they will be quite large, that they will be designed to help states build systems, not to continue to think piecemeal, but to really attack the issue of promoting a system of quality in a very real way. So while I can't answer it with a dollar figure, I can say that the intent is that these are real, sizable dollars.
Can I just ask, is it all, are there 50 for 50 states, or it's competitive, so any idea of the number of grants that will be?
It is competitive. We don't know how many grants there will be. As I said, there's two different types. They're tiered, essentially. There's something called a Pathways Grant, which are states that are further ahead, and then there are development grants. We expect there will be a larger number of development grants than there will be Pathways Grants. We have heard there will be somewhere from as few as three, as many as 10 of these higher level grants, and as few as 10 and as many as 25 of the lower level grants. So there's a fairly significant difference there.
Representative Kulik Jackson.
Do you know if the $8 billion over 8 years is going to be like $1 billion a year? And do you reapply every year, or might it be possible to apply for something that has longevity built in?
Yes. I think it'll be $1 billion a year over 8 years, but we're not sure. That could change. But it will be the first tier grants, the high level grants, the Pathways grants, are 5-year grants that are renewable. Very important point. The development grants, the second level grants, are 3-year grants that are not renewable, but the intent is that having had a development grant, you would then be in a position to apply for a Pathways grant. So the intent is to move states through quality to higher level of investments so that we can keep making change.
Okay. Thank you.
So I keep talking about a metric. What does that mean? The metric or the measure of success and of the application's goals is as follows. Every state will establish goals and benchmarks showing how they will lead to a greater percentage of disadvantaged children participating in high-quality programs. Those children will be birth to five, and the state will establish a baseline. In other words, the Early Learning Challenge Fund is pushing states to ask, where are the children each and every day? What are they getting in terms of quality? What kind of activities are they being served with? How are the programs that they're in connected to health, to nutrition, to the kind of supports they need? Are we, in fact, serving our infants and toddlers, our preschool age children, our pre-K children, and making sure that the services they get are connected to each other, connected to K-12, and connected to what we know really, really works to achieve the kinds of outcomes that we want? So that's what the metric does. Of course, every time I say that, people nod, and then they go, wait, what does that mean? Not really sure I understand it. So here's some more information from the bill about what that means. States will be required to prioritize investments in quality. So the things that we know work, professional development, mentors, coaches, foundational grants to programs to help them retain staff, to improve compensation, the pieces of quality, whether it's making sure that there's enough square footage for every child, making sure the state can go visit programs who were interested in quality, helping individual programs access local resources that will give their children more preventative care. All of those pieces will be in place. and then the baseline, the description of how the funds will really look at the number and percentage of disadvantaged children. And again, that those words are broken out quite clearly in the proposed legislation by each age group. So a state will not be allowed to invest in one age group and say that they have raised the quality of programs. It's about thinking about infants and toddlers at the same time we're thinking about preschool age children. Thinking about children with developmental delays and disabilities and the quality of the programs serving them. Children with limited English proficiency. And thinking about those children living in rural areas. A lot of our interventions often occur in urban environments. We think about disadvantaged children in urban environments. And we fail to remember that there are children all throughout a state, and how can we make sure that every child who is disadvantaged has access to high quality? That's the metric that they'll be looking at. Again, I get more questions. Disadvantaged is defined in the bill as children in families who have income at or below 85% of the state median income level. That translates to about 200% of poverty. Children are defined. I love that children are defined. It's one of my favorite things in the bill. I keep looking at my 9-year-old son and saying, I'm sorry, you're no longer a child. You're not defined. Child is defined as birth through 5. So there is absolutely no ambiguity that this is a birth to 5 bill. It's not a kindergarten bill. It's not a pre-K bill. It's a bill for children birth to 5. Limited English proficiency is defined. Higher quality is not defined. Often when I say that, I'm met with looks of question and disbelief. What do you mean they didn't define higher quality? I think it's important that this is left to the state. States are in such different places that we want to make sure that the funds that are used in ways that really start where programs in your state are and move them along a quality continuum. And don't, by defining in an odd way, lock out some of your programs or make a state automatically unable to compete because the definition of higher quality is wrong. I think it's also important to remember that the metric is moving more children into higher quality, which means that not only are programs moving along the continuum, but you're increasing the number of programs at the top. So we're trying to get in both sides. Finally, early learning program is defined. Just to be clear that it includes all the programs that children are in. It includes family child care, it includes center-based child care, it includes Head Start, it includes state-funded pre-K, it includes programs funded by your local education agencies through Title I and other sources that may be in public schools. It includes early intervention dollars. It includes any early childhood setting where a child birth to 5 is. This is about building a system of quality for our most disadvantaged children.
We have a question. Representative Greiling.
Yes, ma'am.
Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Miss Ewan, I'm wondering, our governor's proposed cutting sliding fee child care by 5%,
mm-hmm.
and I notice here later on in your slides you've got the maintenance of effort and that we're supposed to be increasing the number and percentage of low-income children, which of course are the ones in sliding fee child care, and I'm wondering how, if the legislature should agree and or be backed in a corner and have to cut anything like sliding fee child care, how that would impact the ability of Minnesota to receive this grant.
Ms. Ewan?
I think, obviously, that's one of the key questions. The grant application, as it's currently written, does not require its own maintenance of effort. It does not require its own state match, which is a recognition of where states are in terms of their own budgets and the economic recession and the level of deficit in the states. What this financial metric asks is that states, and ignore the 2006 that's on the slide, I'll get to that in a second. Basically, what the successful grant applicants will do is show that they have tried to hold their early childhood system harmless, that they continue to fund their child care subsidy program by meeting the match and the maintenance of effort requirements. In other words, they're not leaving any federal dollars on the table, that they continue to participate in IDEA, infant, toddler, and preschool programs, that they're not saying, well, we're interested in quality, but we're not going to serve children with delays. That they continue to fund public pre-K, Head Start, and early Head Start investments at the levels that they were at. I think that in Washington, a hold harmless is seen in many quarters as a compromise, i.e., we're not asking for new money to be put on the table, but we are asking that the states show at least a minimal commitment by not cutting where it's at. I do recognize that's going to be difficult for some states, and I think that that's going to be an important question. I think for a state that is spending above its maintenance of effort or its match, that it's going to be very tempting to say, well, here's this is the obvious cutoff. They've put the line in the sand. So as long as we don't go below that, we're okay. But I think the intent of making sure that you're not making it more difficult for low-income families to access child care programs is also important and will be something that the application will ask for. So, for instance, a proposed cut in reimbursement rates will make it more difficult for low-income families to access child care. Those providers will not be able to provide quality because they won't have the dollars in hand to buy the materials and resources they need. They won't be able to participate in quality rating systems. They will lose qualified staff because they won't be able to pay the same level of salary. And they may stop taking children on the subsidy system because they just can't afford it anymore. They can't afford the loss. So those kind of decisions that really limit access and limit quality are more harmful, I think, than those kind of cuts that go to the system part of where children are and what they get really need to be looked at in a different kind of a light. So I let me say that we in Washington fully understand where states are and that every piece of legislation coming out of Washington right now is trying to understand the fiscal situation in states. But this kind of a program that is designed both to do something brand new and to put significant high-level dollars on the table has to be seen that way, and it will require states to do at least something. So I think that's the interim answer. Is that a good Washington answer?
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, my last question is, and maybe the fiscal staff could help me or the chair, how much would we be saving, so to speak, if we cut sliding fee child care by 5%? As the governor's proposed, and how much is the potential range for Minnesota should we get this grant?
I can't answer what the percentage cut is.
Ms. Adrians, you?
I think, Madam Chair, members, it's about $5.4 million, if I remember correctly.
And again, we don't know what the size of each individual grant is yet, so I wouldn't want to put a number out there that would be misleading.
And Ms. Ewan, I meet with testifiers before committee, sometimes especially they're out of town, and you mentioned the timeline is the fiscal year for the federal government is September?
September 30th. So this is a very interesting piece of legislation because even though it hasn't passed yet, the administration believes it will. And so they are starting to plan for it too. And in fact, if you look at the president's budget, it's pretty clear that he expects that the Department of Education and the Department of Health and Human Services will be implementing grants this summer. Our fiscal year ends September 30th, 2010. It appears that they think that they will start moving grants by then. So there will be a quick turnaround for applications. Let's say that the bill passes in March or April. We'll start to see regulation and guidance in April and May. We would see applications in May, June, July, which could be due as early as September or early October. So they clearly want to start moving the grants out. I would say that a state that starts to prepare for their applications, that goes through the thinking in the metrics that we're talking about now, that really thinks about the activities in their state that are building quality and what they want to do to go further down that road, that those states will be highly competitive because most states are not that far along in this system of quality and won't be ready to apply.
So, and I connect those two members because you look at, if we do the cuts and did what the governor is proposing, it's going to be right on the heels of this application. And so it really could be damaging in terms of our chances. So I think we really have to think about that. Representative Kulik-Jackson.
I'm wondering if you have any recommendations about sort of governmental structure because, with early childhood, part of it is Department of Education, part of it is Human Services. And what can a state do short term sort of structurally to, help make this go better, for lack of a better term?
Well, fortunately, Minnesota is in a very good position to answer that question. When I got here this morning, one of the first things I said to folks was, what is the status of your Early Childhood Advisory Council application? You may be aware that under the economic stimulus dollars, $100 million was made available to the states non-competitively. Every state can access some part of it. to create an early childhood advisory council and move forward with plans to think about systems for the early child, for how to build a system of early childhood. And your state submitted their application yesterday. Congratulations. You have wonderful state staff who made that happen. You're only the fifth state to get that application in. So you are already thinking about how to do that. I would suggest that given that the Early Childhood Advisory Council has a plan in place, that will soon have a grant in hand to do some of the work we're talking about, to do some data analysis, to think about professional development initiatives, that the Early Childhood Advisory Council is probably a good place to think about planning for this application, to think about moving forward. I know some of the subcommittees are thinking about some of the metrics here, are thinking about the pieces of a statewide professional development system, how a quality rating and improvement system works, accountability pieces, that's the place to start, very much so.
And members, just so you know, I'm a member of the Early Childhood of the Governor's Council, and the department did work very hard on that grant and got it in. And if we get that strategic planning grant, I think it's almost guaranteed. Those are more certain. There's going to be a lot of strategic planning done on early childhood. We are in conversations preliminarily with the commissioner about the responsibilities of the advisory council and perhaps what should be added or legislated. The session that we would like the council to do, and this is perhaps something we should think about, is asking them to take a look at this, because as you heard, this the faster we can get ready, then, because can you imagine pulling, I don't know, Race to the Top took months to pull together. If they had to pull together an application in 2 or 3 months, I think, I know the staff is up there, some of them, it's going to be a long summer, I mean, or a short summer, because you're going to be, it would be a lot of work, and so the more we can do to prepare. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. This is very interesting. I was initially kind of intrigued because one of the things that I've felt is that the targeting towards the most disadvantaged is maybe the premium objective for me in an early childhood environment. And you started out talking about getting funds directly to kids, and my mind started gravitating more towards the credits and the scholarships kind of approach. But then you started to describe big systems and kind of a systems approach, and I'm a supporter on the record supporting our Race to the Top grant, in large part because it seems to me that it's starting the creative destruction process of a big bureaucratic kind of union bureaucratic complex that seems to run the K-12 system. And yet this seems to be almost the reverse, like we're going to be doing grants to actually build the big complex. So can you maybe just rationalize for me or separate those two, the building of a big system approach as compared to getting the money directly to the kids?
Mm-hmm. Ms.
I think that the Early Learning Challenge Fund is designed to do exactly that latter piece. When you look at the proposed uses of funds in the House language, most of the money needs to go to the programs serving disadvantaged children, to do things like increase salaries and compensation so you keep the best teachers in front of those children on a daily basis, making sure that those programs have enough books and materials and toys and chewing rings for those children, that what we saw in the video about a bunch of children sitting in car seats watching TV never happens because you've trained teachers to do the right thing. I think that the systems piece that you keep hearing me talk about is about finding out where children are, data, knowing where those children are every day, what's happening with them, and making sure that the programs that they are in then get the resources they need to do better. So the systems piece is making sure that you know what's going on and that you drive resources, whether it's professional development, whether it's foundational grants to build quality, whether it's mentors and coaches, to those programs to help them do better.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions. I'll hold off on most of them, but just hearing what you say, this is starting to actually scare me. You mentioned, in kind of a joke, that we're going to define what a kid is, right? And that's kind of the classic big bureaucratic approach, right? You define everything and everyone, and all of a sudden you're just a number on a board, and then you talked about knowing where they are every day. And I got to tell you, I mean, as a parent and as a person concerned about what the federal government is doing as it starts to kind of push down into the K-12 system, thinking that the federal government is going to be kind of defining for the state what it should define down to this level for parents and what's going on in their kids' lives. Wow, I think we need to have a serious discussion. The funding is appealing, and some of the mechanisms, the data-driven, research-based things might be appealing. But wow, if the end of this thing is that the state is going to know where every kid is at every moment of every day and structure that, that's a bigger discussion that we need to have as a legislature than just the mechanics of a grant process.
I think that those are very important concerns to raise, and I'm glad you've raised them. The reason the bill defines child as birth to five is making sure that the funds go to children who are not in K-12, where funds currently don't go. So that's the reason for the definition. I think that the fact that the bill doesn't define higher quality and leaves that up to a state to understand its criteria, its characteristics of quality, is a very important piece. I think that when we're talking about NAEP scores and AYP scores and third grade reading scores, that we need to be very cognizant of the fact that when we're seeing disparities in reading and language development and social, emotional, and physical development at 9 months, that we have to think differently about what happens to children who are in out-of-home settings on a regular basis. And so what we need to do is make sure that those folks who are with those children every day, that those the parents have the resources to understand what quality is, and that the folks that are caring for those children have what they need to make sure they're doing the best possible job with those children. It's not about saying to parents, you don't know what quality is. It's about saying to parents, we know you know what quality is, and now we're going to make sure it's available, especially in low-income communities where many families often have no choice at all. And so this is really a bill about changing how children are in care in a way that makes sure that they are cared for in the best possible way, rather than what we saw in the video, which is children in car seats watching TV. You heard a two-year-old say, what I really want to do is run around. Why can't I run around? The reality is he can't run around because in his community there are no safe play spaces. His child care provider can't afford to invest in a climbing gym. His mother can't afford a child care center where there are enough caregivers to make sure that it's safe for him to run around. That's what this the Challenge Fund would do, is make those resources available to providers so that parents can finally choose the quality that they want and need for their children.
Here's what I'd like to do is Ms. Ewan has to leave at 5:30. We'll take your follow-up, Representative Downey. I'd like to give her about 10 minutes, members, to get through as much as she can, and then we can finish up with some questions. But Representative Downey, if
thank you very much for your indulgence, Madam Chair. So this is, I think, a quick question. So is there anything in the challenge grants that would actually drive the programs or the funding in a way that more kids would actually be able to stay in their actual home? And is there anything in there that would kind of drive scholarships or credits or money directly to the family and the kids, or is it kind of all geared towards the centers and the out-of-home care environments?
Ms. Shannon?
The current House draft includes the opportunity for states to potentially use dollars for access, yes. So, yes, some of the dollars, if the legislation goes forward as written, could be used for direct service, for access, potentially. To your first question, parents choose where they put the children now, and the fund doesn't in any way change the rules around your child care subsidy system that says how many hours a family has to work before they qualify for a subsidy. It doesn't change any of the rules in your TANF program that requires parents to work in order to get their general assistance. It doesn't change any of those things. It just talks about quality in child care where children already are.
Well, Ms. Ewan, let's see if we can go, if we can get through the rest of your presentation, and then we'll take some questions before you have to head off for your plane.
Sure. So the other metric that I think is really important as we're thinking about serving low-income children in higher quality settings is the renewal measures, which are increasing the percentage of disadvantaged children by age group, but importantly, increasing the high-quality early learning programs in communities, in low-income communities. And one of the things that we've seen across the country when states have made an effort to invest in quality is that it's often in a center-by-center way, that there's very little effort to really think about a community, and that children are the children are in a catchment area for a school, but they may not go to a single school. They may go to five or six different schools. And how do you really serve the whole community and make sure that every child who lives there has access to a high-quality program rather than the children in one part of that community? So the metrics we really want will really drive states to think about all of the early childhood components in a given area, a county, a town, a local education agency district, those kind of things. And I think that's an important piece of the fund because it will really help to build the system at the local level, something that we've had a hard time doing. It will connect Head Starts and child care and public school pre-kindergarten programs as well as state pre-K. It will help connect the community resources that that provide preventive health and dental health and mental health services to young children. So thinking, again, in a community way as well as about the direct interventions we're doing with children in child care settings. As we already talked about, there are some financial measures around state maintenance of effort and MOE for the child care subsidy program, the match you've already put up for the Early Child Advisory Council, and other public expenditures. The last point I think is very important on the slide. For grant renewal, states will be evaluated on their commitment of resources to support the programs. In other words, over the 5 years that you have the grant, what did the state do to really build quality on its own and to build towards the metric of access to higher quality? The House bill has fairly significant data requirements. I will say right now that the level of specificity in the House bill probably will not be echoed in the Senate bill, but I think knowing what kind of data was proposed will be very important for a state that's thinking about planning, that's thinking about how to move forward for an application, because these are the kinds of questions that will measure success. And they have to do with quality, they have to do with the workforce, qualifications and compensation of the workforce, they have to do with understanding disparities in access to quality, that is, if 60% of the low-income preschoolers in your state have access to a level 4 program, but only 12% of the infants and toddlers in the state have access to a level 4 program. How are you addressing that disparity? And that will be seen as a problem within the context of the administration of the fund. Thinking about disparities by geographic area, really trying to look at the distribution of funds so that they're not concentrated only in urban areas, making sure that children who reside in rural areas do have access to high-quality programs as well. Again, you can see that the House bill thought about every possible way that we described children and wants to collect data on them in those ways. Children who are developmentally delayed, family income, child age, disability, limited English, how individual programs in the state are participating in the quality rating system. Again, this is data not just for the sake of collecting data, but rather to do trend analysis to get back to the goals and benchmarks on the original metric. The fund is truly designed to ensure that more disadvantaged children get access to higher quality programs. And it will hold the state accountable for showing both how they've raised quality and how they've gotten more children into those programs. More data from the state. The Secretary of Education will report back to Congress so that Congress knows how the program is working. And these are the kinds of things that Congress will receive information on. And it's very similar to what we talked about for the state. So what can a state do now? I think, as I said, that one of the most important things a state can do to think about applying is really start to understand the data on where children are, to develop the infrastructures to invest in the Early Child Advisory Council. So on data, right now, as Dr. Jim Lombardi, who's the Assistant Secretary for Early Childhood at the Department of Health and Human Services, likes to say, on any Monday morning, we know exactly how many people saw Avatar over the weekend and how much they spent. And we're good with that. That's something we want to know. But we don't know how many children are in high-quality early childhood programs on that same Monday morning. And that what we need to know is that kind of data, the same kind of data that we report for industries we should know about early childhood. And so the fund is going to position states to do that. And for states themselves to be ready to apply, they need to start thinking about where those children are and what they're getting. In your state, as in other states, what that really means is thinking about data reporting requirements across programs, data interoperability? Do your state programs talk to each other, and to what degree do they talk to each other? Are you collecting, are you duplicating some of your data collection that you could stop duplicating and really think about better ways to get data from children and families and providers? Understanding where some of your state investments around quality are going and how they're really pushing quality up and if they're the most effective investments. And whether there are disparities by age, income, and other risk factors. Are there pockets of the state that have no high quality programs? Why is that? What are the reasons behind that? Looking at some of your subsidy and licensing policies and understanding whether and how they are promoting high quality or they're getting in the way of access to high quality programs. So an assessment of all of the state pieces that will build towards a quality system in advance of the application will be very important. Using the Early Child Advisory Council, implementing the plan that's already been put in place and hopefully will be funded quickly. And finally, really looking at the components of the quality rating and improvement system. Your state has a pilot. It's important to understand how that's working. It's important to understand whether the rating and improvement piece is really in place and how it's helping to move providers through the quality rating system. So our providers coming in and getting stuck at a one or a two, or over time are they moving through the system so that you're really producing more and more programs who are operating at that highest star program? So I'll stop there and see if there are other questions or comments or concerns.
Members, questions? Well, I think we'll see if the members can think of a question or two here. I think for me, I mean, it seems like we've been trying to pull a lot of this information together, and we did everything from the inventory bill, where we're trying to inventory early childhood programs, to trying to get good data. I mean, the only way, if we're going to close the achievement gap, I mean, and a lot of the committee members here sit on K-12, is you do have to start tracking kids. I mean, there is no other way to close an achievement gap or to make sure kids are improving than you're seeing what each kid does and helping them make the appropriate improvements. I mean, it's actually a pretty basic thought. On early ed, though, of course, I think for all of us, we have to think about how to translate that and get it down to a much simpler type denominator. Representative Kulik-Jackson.
You had said something about that this grant demands that the majority of the money be put into programming instead of administration. I think it's a little bit in response to Representative Downey's concern that we don't build a bureaucratic behemoth over this. Are there percentages? I mean, how does that happen to make sure that it really the money goes to the children?
I think when you see the final legislative language, there will be very strict recommendations about the percentage that is for programs to improve their quality versus more systems pieces. Right now, the House bill isn't quite as specific as I think the final legislation will end up being for exactly some of those concerns about it's important to invest in systems pieces, but it's really important to build quality where the children are. And so let's make sure the bulk of the dollars goes to where children are. So I think there will be some requirements.
Representative Kulik-Jackson.
I'm from a rural area, and one of the challenges besides poverty is distance and geography and transportation. Do you know if that's ever been a consideration on how to make sure that that people can get access?
Ms. Yuen?
Yeah. The issues around rural programs are very much at the forefront of the thinking, particularly of the Department of Health and Human Services right now. They have an initiative around rural programs. They're actually holding an institute outside of Kansas City in March, I believe, to deal specifically with child care issues for rural communities. It's very much at the forefront of their thinking. The transportation issues, not just for the children, but how do you get providers access to the training they need to move through the system? The number of children, how spread out children are, and the number of children it takes to really make a quality center versus a family child care. So there are some interesting ideas. There are ways of linking family child care providers so that you end some of their isolation. There are ways of doing distance learning with them, of creating learning communities. There have been some programs. Illinois has a program. Some other folks have programs where they do essentially an itinerant teacher model where you have a master teacher or a mentor who travels to different providers throughout a rural community. And then on, so like one of each of the 4 days, she travels to the different. And on the fifth day, all of the providers bring their children to a common space, if that's possible. And they do professional development together. And then there's childcare for the children as well. So there are lots of models out there. And my crystal ball says that if and when this becomes law, that the departments will be putting out models and guidance to help folks think about some of those issues and some initiatives that they can put in place.
Representative Ornas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have missed this because I came in a little late, but I guess my question is where the federal government is getting this money. Is this a first time for this grant application, and is it part of the stimulus funding, or is it separate?
This is new money that some of you may be aware that the federal government, the administration has recommended reforms to the student aid. The way that student loans are given out, that will generate about $80 billion in savings. Most of that savings is being put back into the Treasury. Some of the savings is being used to invest in this program and several other programs, which will over time also offset the deficit because they will create jobs, they will create new workers, they will create children who are more prepared for a 21st century workforce.
Thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions, members? Representative Lane?
You spoke of pathway grants and development grants. Could you give some example of a state that would be ready for a pathways grant?
I would love to, but again, it's so vague right now, it's unclear. I can tell you that if a state has a quality rating system that is fully implemented and evaluated, they may be in a better position than a state that has never said the words quality rating and improvement. Other than that, I can't give you much more specifics.
I will just say the rumor mill, I mean, what we kind of hear is it is the states that are much more advanced on this. You do know, I mean, there's another sort of rumor idea along these lines is there's people in Minnesota that are talking about getting on the committee to decide who gets these. Is there going to be a committee to decide who's going to get the grants, or is it going to be sort of a bureaucratic, is it going to be a department that drives it, or is it going to be volunteers from all over the country from different states, or...
It's going to be a competitive application process, much like Race to the Top, where the Departments of Education and the Departments of Health and Human Service will come together and have a grant reading process with qualified evaluators. They will establish criteria for the grants, and the most competitive states will win. It should be a pretty open process, pretty transparent. It should be a pretty quick process. I think that the guidance that will come out in anticipation of the applications will very clearly lay out what the criteria will be against which applications will be measured and will state what reviewers will be looking for. Reviewers, I would expect, will have pretty substantial knowledge of state early childhood systems and will understand what a quality rating system is and what the investments are that make a difference for quality. But that, again, is me understanding how past grants have been done rather than anything that's been put out for this grant.
So could there be a reviewer from Minnesota?
There could be.
They apply. That's probably a different process.
Yeah, that would be a very different process.
So it's all connected in. But what we hear out there is it's kind of unfortunate we don't qualify for the top tier because it's so much bigger money. But it sounds like we'll have to go through the process, but it sounds like we're just not quite there yet.
Yeah. Although I will say that it's pretty clear that states will be competing against each other. And so... I wouldn't assume that you're not that you won't be competitive for either level, given that you don't know who else is applying.
Okay.
So I think that's why I think it's so important to come out and start thinking about how to apply, because while I don't think it's a case of the early bird gets the worm, I do think it's a case of the better prepared a state is to make the application, the better that application will come across, and therefore will be more competitive.
So, Representative Lane, maybe we apply for both. I guess there'll be a lot of contemplation when the application comes across based on that, which sounds like it'll be right after we adjourn. A surprise. that tends to happen. We're only in that through May. Any other questions? We'll get you out a couple of minutes early to catch your plane. Thank you. I think it was very helpful for me to understand and hopefully members. And is your contact information on here if the members would like to?
I'm not sure it is, but it is on the very first page.
So if they'd like some more contact or more questions, members, feel free.
I'm happy to answer any and all questions. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. We're glad to have you here. And then we're going to, the next thing we're going to do is take down to the department level and have MDE come up, Carol Carlson, and talk about on a state level on their perspective on the Early Learning Challenge Fund. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about the Early Learning Challenge Fund and the challenges it will bring forward. I want to talk to you about how we're positioned already to go in this direction, and then how we can get even more positioned. And I've sort of picked out some areas of the challenge grant that I think we could talk about our what we have done in those areas. And of course, we at the department are used to working with the federal government, and we're not quite as we don't think they'll act quite as fast as Ms. Ewan said, but it could happen. I'm willing to be surprised. But and we know we do also recognize that the Senate may change some of the provisions. So, but generally, I think there's agreement about which areas will be included. So I wanted to talk to you first about alignment of early learning standards, and those are important in the challenge grant. They have the standards have to lead to school readiness and be integrated with other program quality guidelines, and they have to be able to guide curriculum and assessment. And I talked a little bit about how our early learning standards have been around now for a decade for 3 to 5 year olds, so we're in good position there. And our 0 to 3 year olds, those standards have been around since 2007. We've got these standards aligned with our kindergarten standards. We've got the standards aligned with the indicators in our school readiness sample assessment, and we've got the standards embedded in the parent aware pilot. So we're pretty strong in the standards area. Then we go to the rating system, and as Ms. Ewan said, we're in a pilot phase, but in the challenge grant, it's important that the quality rating system have progressive levels of quality, and that it's used across a variety of early learning settings, and that it's research-based. We're in position on all three of those points. We just don't have it statewide yet. So you have the statute you gave us last year about getting the quality rating system statewide. We're in the second year working that statute. I think we're in pretty good shape there. The ERA funds that are going to be allocated to the Governor's Council, we have some of those funds, as you'll recall, going to the cross-agency work group that's getting the QRS in line. And we have specifically in our quality rating system, we require curriculum and assessment, child assessment review in the approval process. So again, we're strong there. The third area is professional development, and that's obviously to get a qualified workforce. And we have made some recent good inroads there, but there's a lot more work to do in this area. We do embed the early learning standards in every professional development opportunity that we at MDE offers. And we also look every year at those school readiness results and offer what professional development opportunities we are able to offer, we offer aligned with the results of those studies. So we've been concentrating on literacy areas and numeracy areas, because that's where every year we see the kids from low-income families falling short. DHS, as you know, recently established the Center for Professional Development. You had that legislature, that bill, a couple years ago now. I don't know, time flies, you know. And on the other hand, it stands still. But that's to create a registry that tracks training, and it also has an approval process for trainers and training content in it. So that's an important piece to show off, too, in the challenge grants. Your bill that you heard last week directing the $500,000 to spend in preparing providers for the for the QRS. QRIS is also an important piece. The Advisory Council, if you recall, has a set of federal charges and a set of state charges. One of the federal charges is for that council to assess the 2 and 4 year higher ed institutions and how well they're preparing the workforce. That hasn't gotten a lot of attention yet, but it is included in the ERA application to start work on that, and that's an important piece to for both the federal government to see our responsibility with regards to the council, but also for the challenge grant. Then we have, and there's this area that I call strategies for parents to better assess quality and to support their children's learning. And I think we're really strong on the supporting their children's learning. I mean, we've had ECFE for 30 years here, more than 30 years. We've recognized time and time again, all the time, that parents are the first and most important teachers of their kids. The Advisory Council at the first meeting endorsed that principle. I think we line up really well there. The helping parents assess quality is a newer initiative, but MELF and DHS are both working on that, have the website for parents to find the ratings and what the ratings mean. And you've, I think, heard some radio ads that MELF has been doing to help parents figure out the rating system, too. So that's good. We have the website that I've talked about before, MN Parents Know, and that's our website through $50,000 that you give us every year to impart child development information and to parents. And then we have the area of, the next area is sort of screening, referrals, follow-up to referrals. 1977, you gave us the screening law, so that's a good thing that's been around for a long time. It's coordinated with the other kinds of screening, with child and teen checkups. It's coordinated with the Head Start screening. We make referrals, like 20,000 problems a year are identified. I think we could do a better job of following up on the referrals to know that if the kids receive them. And so that's something we'll be looking at in the data systems piece. And then the final area, I think, is this big area of accountability, which includes the data infrastructure. We've, I can't remember if I've mentioned this or not, but we recently applied for a federal grant for MDE's longitudinal data system, and for the first time, we've got some early childhood data elements in there to be connected to the K-12 data elements through the MARS numbers. So that we're going to hear about that, I think, in March, if we get that. So that will help. Hopefully that will happen. The Governor's Advisory Council has prioritized improving outcomes for lowest income kids, and they are looking at including benchmarks and data elements that will measure the progress towards meeting the goals. So, and there's money, I think $100,000 went in the ERA proposal for that. So, and then in the accountability area, too, the coordination of programs at state level should be addressed. And the council has a subgroup looking at offices of early learning. And as you know, we just finished our transfer study of child care to MDE. I think we'll be talking about that next week, maybe. So we have some governance models to make recommendations from too. And then every year, as I've talked about before, we do our snapshot of children in the first 6 weeks of kindergarten, and we will continue to do that, and that looks at all domains, not just cognitive domains, but also social development and physical development. So I think we're in pretty good shape there too. So we've got these, we don't have any full-blown system for sure. We've got these pieces that hopefully, I think what the challenge grant does too, is give us a framework to move these pieces together, because we, you know, have been tending to concentrate on one or the other, or, and it, it, it will give us, I think, good direction and kind of make us together make some decisions that otherwise we would not be doing in a very cohesive fashion. So I think we can be proud of, certainly, of what the council's doing and its energy to do that. Council's taking very seriously its charge of looking at the federal challenge grants, and any federal money there is to be gained will be ready to do it. I don't think my summer will be any longer than your legislative session, so, you know, we're just but we would be happy for you to give us any, you know, guidance in getting ready for it that you see fit. So,
any questions, members? I guess, you know, from my perspective, it's always kind of mysterious how these grants come together. You know, we're never really sure exactly who's working on them or where they're at with them. Race for the Top. There's been some other variety of grants we hear about, and then we kind of inquire, and we're never quite able to track them down. So you're telling me the department's committed to this, they're going to move ahead on this, they're going to start preparing for this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Madam Chair. And I think in this case, now this is an interesting federal process for us, even though we have worked with the federal government a lot. This is two federal agencies, two big guys, working across each other over little kids. So this will be interesting to us too, in how not only the bill shakes out, but how the federal guidance and the rules will come out to us too. So
it's MD and
DHHS, yes. Okay. And that's Health and Human Services at the federal level. So I think it'll be pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, we just hope, being that we might be out of session, that you will keep in touch with us about what the process
Absolutely.
Is. Because
yes.
I think sometimes we over here, we can lose a handle on that. And I think we do want to be involved to some degree. We understand you guys need to write the grant and so forth. You know, I know the commissioner's not here, and I know Karen Klensing's not here, and I know Debbie Hewitt's not here. But I do have a question about the advisory council. So since you're here,
okay.
I thought I'd ask this. I know that they staff the council. I think you do too. It seems we have three more meetings of the council, right? March, something like September and December. And that we did all this work to get the strategic planning grant together. And now it seems like, what do we do now? How is the work plan for the council going to unfold, or are we going to talk about that at the March 9th meeting?
Madam Chair and members, yes, you are going to talk about that at the March meeting. But also, you'll remember that we have these charges, and in the ERA application, we identified some strategies that are in those charges to do, but there is much more work to do than can be funded or than was identified in the application. So the committee structure we're hanging on to complete other work towards those charges.
I've talked with the commissioner, just so I think the committee knows that probably, or yeah. Mentioned that about, it's again sometime on the March agenda. So we could discuss the work plan and how the grants, you know, mm-hmm. work into that, as well as the other charges, and just to be able to have a discussion on that would be
yes.
great if we can fit that in.
Yes, and we don't know, we did get the applications in the mail, but we don't know when we'll get that money either, so we don't really know when that clock will start
exactly.
Ticking. So,
so
we may have
kind of back
a lot of clocks ticking. Yeah.
We have a question, Representative Downey. Did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's a question, maybe it's for the chair, but I'm just going to restate just further comments here. The two biggies, the two big federal agencies are going to be over the kids, and I'm just looking at the Early Learning Challenge Fund description here, and it says the Early Learning Challenge Fund emphasizes a systemic approach, not just funding programs and services, but encouraging states to create an integrated and effective early childhood system. And wow, if that's what our departments are going to do over the summer, I think we need some serious discussion in the legislature this year as to whether or not that's really the direction we want to go. So I don't know. I have a bill that I've been working on that would require some legislative approval of some of the standards and the forms and things, providing a greater level of legislative kind of purview over some of the stuff that's already being promulgated, I assume, by rule or just by practice, around the QRIS and some of these other assessment formats and frameworks and things. And I really think this whole thing should be somehow on the topic, some kind of an authorizing bill or something, so that we can fully debate this in the legislature this year, because this is a really significant, in my mind, significant acceleration in a direction that, frankly, I think it's kind of in the wrong direction, that we should be going more towards the kids and their families and really targeting literacy and disadvantaged kids into those kind of programs where we do see some research-based evidence that it produces outcomes. And here we just keep blasting in this direction in ever greater measure. So can work offline, but I'd like to introduce something that would require us to look at this seriously.
And Representative Downey, you can always introduce any bill you'd like here at the legislature. Any of the members can, and we can even talk about a hearing on that bill. But I think what's frustrating for me is to have it both ways. If you want data and evaluation and have things documented, to me it sounds like this is a grant that's going to do all that. That it is going to have, we're going to know where kids are. We're trying in our schools to close the achievement gap, and the way to do it is to have data and accountability and evaluation. So it, to me, you know, and it would be a debate we could probably have offline, but I think we have to think about the direction. We also, when Race for the Top came down, realized I don't think we were asked if we wanted to do that. I mean, the department's decided to apply for it, as far as I know, because that's what they do. They apply for federal grants. And as you know, there's a lot of controversy from the other side on not, people don't support necessarily what happened with Race to the Top, because we have a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor's office and administration. So it's, I think we'll always have these tensions, and members are, we're free agents, you know, we can think and present ideas and put bills forth on as much as you want to, Representative Downey.
Thank you, and thank you for the chance to just respond briefly, and I appreciate that openness and opportunity to do that, and I think I will. If this were just about building kind of a research-based, data-centric approach to determining where the outcomes are, I mean, I'm still struggling to find any research-based evidence that a QRIS actually drives quality into an early childhood environment and actually produces outcomes for the kids as a direct result of the QRIS. And we just got this new report that shows that the Head Start gains that appear to be seen in kindergarten disappear by first grade. And we've seen lots of evidence that heavy literacy programs and the highly case-managed, really intensive approaches to disadvantaged kids seem to work, but we seem to be going kind of in the other direction. So I just want to push the debate this session and not leave here this spring with that kind of an open question.
Well, with that, we do have a last testifier. So thank you, Ms. Carlson, and we'll continue to talk with the department. We are going to hear about, actually, the Head Start Impact Study Report from Gail Kelly, who's here today to talk about that. I think these federal grants are really interesting. I don't know about everybody else. It's hard. We actually don't control a lot of it. I think the members know that, as the departments control most of it. And with the early, the strategic planning grant, we had a debate in the advisory council, the governor's advisory council, about whether we could see it before it was submitted. Mm-hmm. And so there was an agreement that we would have 3 days to see it. Mm-hmm. And so there was an agreement that we would have 3 days to see it. So it came out the Friday. And I mean, you know, the departments, you know, it came out the Friday before President's Day at what time? 5 o'clock? Mm-hmm. 5 o'clock. And we had people that were off work Monday and they closed it on Tuesday. And so it's hard. And a lot of times we're not in control of this process at all. Now that it's submitted, now that we know we're not fifth to submit, I actually didn't know that till Ms. Ewan told us. I think you'll be able to find it online, I hope, because you might want to, that's 100 pages? Is it 100 pages? Close, yeah. That's something you might want to take a look at too, Representative Downey. There's a lot of data in that grant and a lot of information. Welcome to the committee. You're our cleanup batter for today. So,
wow. Madam Chair, member of the committee,
Glad you're
my
here.
Name is Gail Kelly. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Head Start Association. And I hear the references were raised to the Head Start Impact Study in your committee, and so I've been asked to come and try to summarize something of that report. Well, the Head Start Impact Study extends the previous research that's been done on the effectiveness of Head Start. It was authorized and funded in Congress in part as part of the 1998 reauthorization of Head Start. The study employed a nationally representative sample consisting of over 5,000 newly enrolled 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds children. They were randomly assigned to either a Head Start group or a control group. This is a little different than other randomized early childhood studies that have been done in the past, such as Perry Preschool, because parents of the control group were allowed to enroll their children in other early childhood programs. In the Perry Preschool model, the control group got no other early childhood experience. Data collection started in the fall of 2002, and it continued through the 2006, following children from the spring of their into the spring of their first year in first grade. I think I'll just summarize some key findings and then kind of go over some scientific considerations of the study and then take questions. The first and most significant key finding of the study shows that Head Start works. The authors assert, providing access to Head Start has a positive impact on children's preschool experiences. There are statistically significant differences between the Head Start group and the control group on every measure of children's preschool experiences measured in the study. The Head Start children outperform the control group in every domain of the study, including cognitive, social, emotional, health, and parenting. The Head Start children left Head Start more ready for school than their peers in the control group. And these impacts were found despite the fact that the study's data only represented 6 to 9 months of a Head Start experience. I'll just highlight that the study is over 300 pages long, and it's hard to condense in 10 minutes some of the outcomes, but let me just highlight a few. For example, in comparison to the control group, 3-year-olds who had attended Head Start demonstrated gains in language, literacy, pre-writing, math, and math skills. 4-year-olds in Head Start had gains in language and literacy. Children who attended Head Start as 3-year-olds showed less hyperactivity and problem behavior at the end of Head Start, favorable social skills and positive approaches to the learning at the end of four years, and when they entered kindergarten, they were less hyperactive behavior, increased social skills, and positive approaches to learning. Children who attended Head Start as 4-year-olds were found to exhibit less withdrawn behavior at the end of first grade than those in the control group. In both the 3- and 4-year-old children, children who attended Head Start were more likely to receive access to dental care at the end of their Head Start year and more likely to have health insurance coverage by the end of their kindergarten year.
We have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Dornis?
You can wait.
You want to wait till?
Yeah.
Okay. If you can leave maybe about 5 more minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. I think there's important, some of the benefits extended into first grade, benefits particularly in parenting. Parents of Head Start children reported evidence of a closer relationship with their children than parents in the control group by the end of first grade. Children were less likely to use authoritative parenting styles with children by the end of the age fours and first grade. There are also very good outcomes for special populations. 4-year-olds with special needs benefited from Head Start in math and social-emotional at the end of the first grade. Children in non-urban settings sustained cognitive and social-emotional benefits through first grade. I think what we've heard a lot about in the media is the impacts of the study that do not extend into first grade. And there is no doubt that the study found fewer impacts when children who attended first grade finished first grade. Our opponents would suggest that funding early childhood programs, these losses are reason to divest. But instead, I think we shouldn't discredit programs that work and instead figure out how we continue children's progress into the primary school years. One of the solutions may be to connect the comprehensive services that we offer in Head Start and additional supports through our kindergarten and first grade years. The Head Start community has made a commitment and with the Department of Education, the U.S. Department, and to help share any strategies that we use in Head Start, such as parent involvement, our comprehensive services that work so well in Head Start, to see how they would work in the elementary school years. It's also important to remember that the benefits of Head Start extend well into beyond elementary school. Rigorous peer-reviewed studies have shown positive outcomes for Head Start children as they move through life. We know they're less Head Start children are less likely to need expensive special education services, less likely to repeat grades, more likely to graduate from high school, and less likely to commit crimes and go to jail. There's an extensive body of research that indicates that Head Start works for our country's most vulnerable children. The findings of this study, along with the changes that we've been initiating in the 2007 Head Start reauthorization, point to a continuous improvement in our nation's commitment to at-risk children, and we welcome the opportunity to work with this committee and the education to see that those get extended into their continuing education. Thank you.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelly, this was a national study, right?
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, Minnesota is one of the few states that actually adds money to the federal program. So I guess my question is, has there been any studies in Minnesota to show that our students that are in Head Start are doing better or getting an advantage because of that funding compared to other states that do not have that?
Madam Chair? We don't have any controlled studies such as this that are just in Minnesota. We do have evidence of Head Start working. For example, in our literacy programs, you've seen what's happening with both the AmeriCorps Words Work and for early literacy, that when they're implemented in Head Start, kids do better when they go into school than non-Head Start children without those programs. But we haven't done any controlled research studies here in Minnesota. And just so you know, there were no Minnesota children in this national random sample.
Any other questions, members? I think, you know, members, as we look at programs where I sit on the Autism Task Force, and they're trying to, and so does Representative Mack, and you know how they were trying to compare different kinds of interventions and what's the most effective, and let me tell you, in autism is mind-boggling, isn't it? It's mind-boggling. And in this area, there are a number of different interventions, but I think for kids that qualify for Head Start, very low income, it's a education program, but they're also getting medical and dental and other services. If you have questions about Head Start, I have, you know, as a chair, I take a pretty even approach, but I would, or any program members, I'd encourage you to go visit them. I visit PICA Head Start, which we've heard a lot about in this committee, and I had never visited them. They're basically in an old school building, so it's a huge program, but very impressive from what I saw. I mean, doing a lot of good work, the teachers and the kids, and you know, these are little kids from the poorest areas that are learning, and in my view, I don't know how they couldn't get ahead, you know, when you think about it. But I think as members of the legislature, we need to look at the report and form our opinions and those types of things. Ms. Kelly's the state head, right,
mm-hmm.
of the association.
Right.
So if the members have questions, can they come to you?
Certainly, and if I can't answer them, I'll pass them on to others. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just say one question. So when we talk about the Head Start children kind of having lost their advantages at the end of first grade, was it that the other kids caught up to them, or did they actually kind of regress relative to their peers in that kind of kindergarten to first grade period? Do you know?
They don't have any positive information in the study. So all we know is that they used the same measures when they went into first grade. And we also know that that for our children, the context of those measures are important. So just imagine, you know, the changes that take place when you go into a bigger building with more kids in your classroom, less supports for you individually, and less higher ratios. And we also know that because the teacher has to work with kids who aren't ready, that the teacher is trying to work oftentimes to the lower denominator. And so kids, you see it with your own children, I think. They start to sort of go back to where they were before. We really think that there are a lot of lessons that could be learned as we think about how the strategies that are used with low-income kids and Head Start are translated into the primary years. And I think it'll be an exciting opportunity when HHS and the Department of Education work together to look not only at early childhood, but at the Elementary and Secondary Education Act as well.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, that there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, when they get in the school, it changes, but there are so many factors, you know. It's very intense in those early years, but when they get into the school, it depends on, for instance, the class size, I think, can be a factor. The kind of attention that they get, not only within the school, but outside the school with the parents. The kind of resources that the school has, that whole alignment from the preschool through grade 3 really needs some attention. And I think, certainly as they're dealing with the Race to the Top, one of the goals of Race to the Top is really to assure that when our students have continuous learning and continuous progress all the way through, and certainly through grade 3, because that's so essential. And I always think of Jeffrey Canada and his whole endeavor, where you really do all the wraparound services, and you do it all the way through college, because you can't just provide that kind of support through kindergarten or through preschool and then expect that it's going, then just drop it. It needs much attention all the way through, and we don't have those systems always in place, and we haven't certainly evaluated what are the factors that would lead to a child not being able to continue that momentum. It could be many, many, many things.
You want to respond? We also have one more question. So
I just would totally agree with I think that what we find is those comprehensive services are key. And again, just an example of that is during the snowstorms in Washington, D.C., one of the most critical issues for those children that weren't able to access school was that they couldn't get school lunch and school breakfast. So, again, remember, those comprehensive services are key to our children that are living below the poverty line.
Representative Hamilton.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it's more of a statement here, and I'm trying to get my mind around this as well, because there are many factors that play into this, and there are different ways to reach different children as well. And I just go back the history of myself, you know, and as far as what the environment was, I know growing up, and when I graduated high school, I never thought college was an option. That's why I never went. And idle hands getting in trouble, and I had an uncle that threw me on a farm and said, kid, I'm going to work you and work you hard. Welcome to the real world. I made $9,000 a year and had absolutely no benefits, right? Mm-hmm. That's how I got started in life. And then I take a look at what I wanted for my children. And my wife works. We've been married for over 20 years. She worked all the time. I work two jobs now. But our children, we knew what we wanted for our children. And when my wife was working, we actually had them going to some friends that we knew in the country. That's where they went to daycare, right? So they didn't go through a program like this. But we put, as a family, put a strong emphasis on education. My son, I'm happy to report, he's a senior in high school. He scored 31 on his ACTs. Mm-hmm. He's been accepted to 8 different colleges and is applying for the presidential scholarship on a few of them. Our daughter's a 4.0 student. You know, as a family, put a strong emphasis on this. And it's something that we decided as a family that we're going to really focus on that for our kids, because I see where I started in life and see where others start in life as well. And what I'm concerned about is if we make a structured system that we take away the flexibility from parents as far as what they want to do to be involved and how they want to educate their children at very early stages in life is on one side. And then on the other side is if we have something very structured and we bring these children in, because we all want to provide them with a great opportunity, and we want them to seize that opportunity as well. if we have a very structured system and we identify those kids and we teach those children and we provide the best tools and resources, and then they go right back home to an abusive home, what, you know, are we going to be able to address the full component, you know, and offer the flexibility to where we don't feel like that we're being mandated or forced into something as well? And again, thank you for allowing me to ramble there a little bit. But
these are not easy situations, nor do they have easy answers. I don't know, Ms. Kelly, do you want to respond?
Yes, Madam Chair and Mr. Hamilton. Head Start is a first and foremost a parent involvement program. First of all, parents choose to participate in Head Start. And as part of the governance policy of Head Start, parents are on our governing board for Head Start. So I would say this is the most parent-friendly and parent-inclusive program that you'll ever find. And I really welcome you to come visit and talk to the parents, because they will tell you it's their program. And the decisions that are made from everywhere in terms of what kind of grants they can apply for are first and foremost a parent's decisions. So I think one of the outcomes, the strongest outcomes in these studies that continued into first grade, are in the parenting and the support for parents. So I will welcome you to visit and hear how parents' choice is all about Head Start.
Well, members, we are past time, so I'm going to adjourn the committee. We can continue the discussion another time and outside of the hearing as well. With that, we are adjourned.